Hi there, listener. It's Matthew. You've come looking for an episode of the Children's Book Podcast, and you've found it. Hooray! But you're probably wondering why the name of the podcast has changed. After 8 years of doing the Children's Book Podcast, I began a new career as head of podcasts at A Kids Company About, where I now oversee a podcast network dedicated to producing original content that talks up to kids, centers the things going on in their world, and engages and challenges how they see the world and themselves. All of the episodes of the Children's Book Podcast are still here, but now, if you're subscribed, you'll get new episodes of Worth Noting, a kids podcast about current events, hosted by me. Something for you and the young people in your life to enjoy together. Enjoy this episode, and I hope you'll check out Worth Noting and other podcasts from A Kids Company About. Meet Dan Santat, author, illustrator, Caldecott winner, time traveler. Welcome to All the Wonders, the Children's Book Podcast. I'm Matthew Winner. Things have changed a little. New name, new logo, new music. By the way, thank you, Brian Wund, for the beautiful new logo, and Emily Arrow, she's the one you're going to hear singing in just a second. Your loving touches make this place feel even more like home. Well, for nearly 250 episodes, this podcast was known as Let's Get Busy, but change has long been overdue. I thank you for coming with me on this journey. This is episode number 249 of the podcast with Dan Santat, author, illustrator, most recently of Are We There Yet? But perhaps you had a chance to read and love Beagle, his Caldecott-winning picture book. Dan's newest picture book will have you looking at the story in a whole new way. Okay, pun kind of intended. There's a feature worked into Dan's newest book that quite simply and quite effectively allows the reader to travel back in time with the characters in the book. I love it. My students love it. Everyone wants to hold this book to see if the time travel works when they read it. That's the kind of wonder we're talking about here. Real and pure. Here's episode number 249 of the podcast with Dan Santat. Welcome back to the podcast, Dan Santat. I am glad you're here.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be back.
Hey, and nice to do a little time travel here. Me being, me talking to you from the future, as it were.
I know, right? You reached out to me a couple months ago about trying to fit you in the schedule, because now, God, what, last time we spoke was like 2 years ago.
It seems like it, yeah. Well, I'm glad to see that it
and
is
And now
here.
Look at you.
But it's just moments. Dad. I know.
I told you, your podcast was going to be all popular now.
You're so sweet. It's all popular.
Let me see if I can fit you in the schedule there.
You're ridiculous.
I'm glad that you stuck to it. It's one of these things I like to listen to when I go for a jog.
You're very sweet. I think that I've continued to lead it the way that I did back when I talked to you, which is just that I want to have it be a conversation between me and you, and then I'm excited that there are people that want to listen, because it just gets to be me being a fan over and over, and you know, you come on and it's just that. I get to talk to you about Are We There Yet? And as I said, I read this book with you like a year ago. I've been excited to talk to you for forever, so putting you into a schedule is weird. Like, it's weird that I put you into my schedule like 8 months in advance. Who plans things 8 months in advance? Certainly not. Teachers, the only planning teachers do 8 months in advance is that we start school and we're already planning for summer vacation.
The whole even like publicity for this project for Are We There Yet was way different than Beagle, you know.
Um,
I think once they could put, you know, Caldecott on the darn thing, you know, from Caldecott, medalist Dan Santat, then it was like, oh, well, let's get these posters ready. Let's proofread this sucker. Let's make sure all the colors are in order, you know? Oh my gosh, it was, you know,
We'll
and I
move it right
remember,
along.
you know, it's funny because I remember when they first mentioned that, like saying, oh, well, we're going to put some Caldecott medalist Dan Santat on there. And I actually reached out to previous winners. Like I talked to Brian Floca, I talked to the Steds, I talked to John Clausen, all these other folks. And I said, you know, it feels really weird to have that on the book. I really actually don't want it on the book. And they all agreed. They all said, yeah, it's a really weird thing. And the reason being is because when you do that, then you immediately have comparisons to that award-winning book. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
They say, oh, well, if it's from Caldecott medal winning so and so, then this book has to be equally as good.
Of that same caliber or better.
Right. And it's just this tremendous pressure that you have to it's like these big shoes to fill. And that was another thing about it, is that just real there was oh gosh, after winning, there was like I had this anxiety.
Oh,
I
no.
had this anxiety about where do you go from here, you know? Because every year you always want to improve, you always want to get better and better and better, and then you win the medal, and then you kind of get to a spot where you go, well, where do I go from here? What do I do?
Well, and you would have had Are We There Yet? Was done. So now, even more so, like you're saying, what do you write next? Where do you go next?
Right. Well, the funny thing is, so I guess I'll go back a little bit. When I initially pitched the two books to Little Brown, it was Beagle and Are We There Yet? And they actually passed on Beagle. They didn't. I think what happened was that the story wasn't tight enough, so they couldn't really comprehend it. They didn't understand where I was going with it. But they got Are We There Yet? And that was originally going to be the first book out of the two book deal, and then the second book was going to be Untitled, and it could have been Beagle had we gone that direction afterwards. But what ended up happening was, an executive at DreamWorks called me in for a meeting. I actually presented Beagle to them. I just had a sketchbook, and I said, "Oh, I'm working on this idea about imaginary friends." And I think there was something about me verbalizing it rather than having, you know, a loose first draft of the story that they could just easily understand. And then, you know, like, you know, then they optioned it, and then we went back to Little Brown. And we said, oh yeah, well, this thing you passed on, it got optioned by DreamWorks. And then Little Brown said, did we say we didn't want that? Because what we meant was we totally want it, and it's going to be the first book out of the two book deal.
That's amazing.
So Beagle came out, and now Are We There Yet? It's coming out. And you know, this was, I mean, going full circle, if there was any story that I had to think about that I could have as a follow-up to, you know, a Caldecott winning book, I'm glad it was this one. You know, it lets the pressure off. You don't have to. I felt like I got to do something with this book that was very experimental with the properties of how to read a book. And hopefully, I mean, you read it. I hope it works.
I think it works really well, and I think what you're saying too, Beagle was such a personal story for you, inspired by your son, and the story of being noticed and what it means to be loved and seen. That to go from that, which is amazing, that then they recognize you with the Caldecott, but to go from that deeply personal thing to another potentially deeply personal thing, I mean, when you put yourself like that on the page. If it doesn't get recognized in the same way as the other thing does, that can feel like rejection, or can feel like, oh, is this then not as important? And that I can't imagine how difficult that would be. So I think, I mean, I look at it from I've received some recognition in the library world, which is super
That's great.
flattering. But
Awesome.
it's hard then for the next year. Then is like, oh, well. Do I have to be better? Do I have to do more? Am I not doing enough? I'm not getting recognized anymore. They're moving on to somebody else. What's wrong
Right.
with me? And why do you
Right.
let
Right.
yourself get in that place? But we do. This is what we do as humans, comparison is the thief of joy, but it's hard to fight comparison.
Right.
So you're right, to have something so different really helps.
Yeah, yeah. This to me is probably, you know, it's a fun book. It's a much more fun book compared to Beagle. You know, I think it has its strengths in the interactivity. And the book's very much about being in the moment. So what people are going to experience when they read the book is that it's heavily paneled, much like a comic book.
Oh, yeah.
But the intention isn't because, you know, it's because I feel comfortable in the comic medium. But for someone to read a comic book, you can actually take a moment and you can dissect it into fragments. So like in the end papers, for instance, the front end papers, it's the sunrise, and then the back end papers are the sunset. You know, the end papers could be a single image of a sunrise, but if you break it up into smaller components, and, you know, I broke it up into, like, I think, what, 32 little windows of slowly watching the sun rise, then what you're doing is you're breaking up the panels and you're getting really involved in the moment of watching the sunrise. You know, you're admiring each little frame at a time. You're watching it slowly go up. You're appreciating every moment of that sunrise, not just a single image. And with that said, since this book is very, very paneled, very comic paneled, you might struggle a little bit reading in front of a classroom. I know that I have to get in front of kids really closely to show the images. But for the independent experience, that's what I was going for, was the experience of sitting there and looking at every you know, image and enjoying each moment. So you're right. It's a completely different beast from Beagle, but still actually quite personal in its own way. This one, so, you know, Beagle was about my oldest son and the metaphor about his birth and the day he was born. This one's different. This one's for my younger son, because, of course, leave the other kid out. but this story is about my son and just his complete lack of patience, not just about being on road trips, but his eagerness to just grow up and be, you know, old enough to hang out with his brother. Because sometimes, you know, he'll go to birthday parties and they might go to places where someone his age can't go. And he'll feel left out. And he actually said something to me really weird. It was really interesting because he said, you know, I can't wait till I'm such and such age 2 years from now, because then my older brother and I will be the same age. And I said, no. He'll be 2 years older when 2 years pass, you know. And it was this thing. And then he had to think about it for a minute. And he said, oh, I get it. Okay. But for this, you know, I mean, there's little things in the story that I want him to just savor the moment of being young. And, you know, there's little Easter eggs in the story that, I mean, I'll share with you later. You know, definitely something that he'll take in. He'll look at it and he'll say, oh, my gosh, you know, this is something that I can appreciate now at an older age. You know, being young and me having to say, you know, be patient, you know, calm down.
Right.
That's something, it doesn't really stick to a kid at a young age. But then when you're older and you read that same thing over again, it means something completely different.
You've got, okay, there's a lot to unpack here. And I there's so many things you're making me think of that I'm like jotting notes so I don't forget to say things to you. Do you mind if I just share, though, that I think doing it in a with comic panels like that is so smart, because it slows the pacing. The first person that ever told me about how picture books are essentially just like zoomed in graphic novels was Colleen A.F. Venable,
yes,
who was at the time over at First Second.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I thought that was so brilliant to think of that. I had never thought of the pigeon ever again the same way. When you just think that, no, it really is, we're pacing, our page turns are looking from panel to panel. And it's what happens in between those panels that readers get to fill in a comic that's so great. And it also slows the story down. And it also makes me think, though, did you ever read When You Reach Me by Rebecca Stead?
Yes, that was fantastic.
Rebecca in there has this great comment about time travel that we think of time wrong all the time. That it's not like following along this ribbon. The time is really like the faces of a diamond, that every moment is just a separate moment. And so when you have, there's things like that that happen in this book that, that as I reflected on this book for the long time that I got to live with it, it was making me think of more and more things. And when you bring up your son, I think also, so this is a book about time travel, about being so bored in the car that we literally go back in time. And then how do we catch back up to where we are? But I think also, well, first off, there are moments, and I mean this out of love. I know you know that I love your work. I feel like you're just showing off that you can draw every blessed thing, Dan. Because you've got, like, you've got your robots and your dinosaurs and your, and all the medieval stuff and all that. And I'm like, this is like, look how good the your prowess of drawing is in this.
It's funny because when we were doing the dummy of the book, when we were laying out the dummy, I at one point tried to think, can I shove in everything that kids like? And I had a little checklist.
There, yes.
Cowboys, yes, I have cowboys. Trains, yes, I have trains. A knight, yes. Princess, yes. Pirate, yes. Dinosaur, definite yes. At one point, I had a dragon. I had a dragon in there. And
that's awesome.
And the dragon was fighting the knight, and then you know, the publisher, like my editor, Bethany Strout, and I, we had a discussion. We said, well, you know, let's keep this in the realm of reality. Since dragons didn't really exist, we can't have a dragon. And I said, okay, but kids love dragons, you know.
It made me feel the way you pulled this off, and I love to hear that all the stuff that kids love you've sort of intentionally put in there. It made me think of, as you were describing your son growing up too fast or wanting to grow up too fast, it made me think of how I know that you put time aside each day or each week to draw with your sons.
Right.
And how that's a thing that you do. You draw together and you see what it's like for them to draw these different, let's all draw dinosaurs today, or let's all draw whatever random thing you're thinking of and explore what that looks like to draw like that. And it makes me think that there's so many drawings here that I feel like, I look at some of the things that you've done, and I know the things that you've shared through sketches on Instagram or whatever, and it just makes me think, man, I bet you did this book, and a lot of these ideas came from just drawing with your kid and with your kids, and that to me feels right there. That feels deeply personal.
Yeah, yeah. If anything, the hardest part was shoving it into 40 pages.
Oh, okay.
That was so hard, you know, trying to get this in. Entire story into 40 pages. And then, you know, one of the things you had to figure out was, well, what moments in time are worth stopping in for a kid to really enjoy? You know, I thought, oh, it'd be great to have them on a Viking ship. Oh, it would be great to see him, you know, experience the Wright brothers, you know, going to fly, or maybe meeting Thomas Edison, you know, or something like that.
Yes.
And you're just editing out all these great moments, and you're thinking, okay, I think I have room for 4 moments in all of history. What 4 can I choose? You know, and then putting it in a context that a kid can enjoy, you know, so. Like, for example, there's a spread where they're on a pirate ship, but the car is on the plank.
Right.
And, you know, and his response is always something that, you know, pertains to the scene, but not directly. If you notice, throughout the entire book, there's not one moment in the story where the boy actually looks outside of the car. You know, the entire time he's actually just wallowing in his own misery.
Yeah, whereas, I feel sick. My butt hurts. Yeah.
Right, right. So he says, my butt hurts just when a knight is about ready to shove a lance right into the dashboard of the car. What do they say in the desert? I have to go to the bathroom.
Yeah.
I have to go to the bathroom, you know? Just little jokes here and there that reflect the moment in time. Yeah. He's just not aware of it, you know? So,
I love it. I think the way that works, too, to have kids thinking about, you know, not being aware of what's going on the car trip, but yet at the same time being ultra aware of what's going on in the book is sort of a fun juxtaposition to do that.
Right. And it's a subtle thing because, like I said, the boy never looks outside of the car, whereas the parents are, like, as they're going through different moments of time, their clothes
I
are
see their clothes
changing.
are changing,
Their clothes are changing with all the moments of time, and they're looking outside, and they're kind of reacting like, why? Like, it's funny, one of the first spreads that turns around, you know, you turn, and they're suddenly in the Old West, and the mom's wearing a prairie outfit, and the first glance she has, her eyes are just wide open, and she's in front of like a horse's butt, and you know she's shocked, you know, and then on, you know, on the pirate ship, she's ready to throw up, and you know, and then by the time they get into the prehistoric era, the dad now has a full beard, and they're wearing like these, like these, you know, woolly mammoth like rugs, furs, you know. It's and that's kind of the idea of, well, you know, as a parent, if you're on a long road trip and your kid is complaining, you endure every minute, you endure every second of that road trip. Like you're just being dragged along in it, you know? And that's what I wanted to capture.
I think you've done it so well. And there's so many moments in here where I feel like, as an adult, as I was sharing it to kids, seeing their favorite parts, there were moments where I'm like, but this is my favorite part, and I've probably loved this ever since I was a kid, since I was your age. And for me, those moments, you showed me two things in your art in this book in particular.
Oh, what's that?
Of the thing that I loved that I've never seen done in a picture book before, which is that you have a picture. I'll talk. They're both with the dinosaur, with the T-Rex. So you have one where the boy is making eye contact. The one time that he gets out. One mm-hmm. time that he looks, he's making eye contact with that T-Rex, and there's just hearts, like, face to face with the thing that you've loved forever. I've loved dinosaurs forever. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing is seeing a cast of characters riding bareback on top of that dinosaur. That is amazing.
I really love that spread.
I love that spread. You know? And all the panel, the to show almost the all of history in the panels in the background. And it's got like that nice fade on it. So you just have it as like this nice wallpaper background, but it's all there.
That was a tough illustration to kind of work, because there was so, like, if you sucked out all the color and it was just a line drawing, I don't think you'd be able to comprehend what's going on, because there's so much going on that spread. And so color really manages to push that in and out. And also, it was a great opportunity for me to shove in those moments in history that I didn't get to put in the rest of the book. So you'll see the little caveman scene. You'll see the little Viking scene. I unfortunately don't think I got to do the Wright brothers, but... yeah, that spread, man, that took so much time for me to just to get it work just right. And then I had all these characters, and then I actually would erase the characters, and I would draw in, you know, significant historical figures. So I had, let's see on that, you know, there was Blackbeard, there was Annie Oakley, Sacagawea, Ben Franklin, Amelia Earhart, gosh, I'm trying to remember who else I had on there, but it's just I just tried to shove in as many historical figures as I could that kids could relate to. Like I couldn't put, you know, President Polk on there. Kids wouldn't be like, hey, it's Polk.
Well, I think that your illustration is, I mean, you're at the top of your game in this book. It's just so pretty. And even better that you've got these nice full spreads to just put your nose in that book and look at all the details. It's really, really pretty. Oh, and I should even say, are we even talking about sort of the feature that sets aside this book, the way that you can, when you pit, was it that way when you pitched the idea to Little Brown?
No. So
I love that. Okay, that's great.
So let's talk about
it.
This is a really exciting part of the book.
Because by the time this posts, your book will be out, right?
Right.
And so people will discover it, and you've been having a lot of fun on Instagram. I'll link to your feed so people can see what you've been sharing.
Right. So the idea here is, when the boy gets really bored, time slows down. But in the story, he gets so bored that he starts going back in time. And I I wanted to have the reader experience the feeling of going back in time rather than it just existing in the narrative, not just with the images. I wanted them to be able to interact with the book. And I think I was just really, I was at the time, I was really just inspired by Hervé Tillet's Press Here. Just,
yes.
Oh, press the red dot. What happens? You turn the page, you're like, oh my gosh, I made it turn red. and I told myself, like, I would just love to be able to do some kind of project to that level of thinking. Like, I'd be so proud of myself. And I remember one day I was reading a Japanese manga comic to my older son. It was a Naruto comic. And in Eastern culture, like in Japan, they read from right to left. And then here in the Western culture, we read from left to right. And so the whole time we were reading this Naruto comic, it wasn't until we got into like 20, 30 pages in where we started getting comfortable with it. Like the first few pages, the first few chapters, we just kept saying, this feels weird. This feels weird. This feels like it's going backwards. This feels like it's going backwards. And then it just clicked to me. And I said, how can I get a book to end up in this position so that I'm now reading from right to left? And I realized if I just turn the book upside down, then we're in business. And so I remember presenting the idea to Little Brown. And Little Brown, you know, this crazy idea, like Little Brown, of course, was a little skittish about it. They said, well, we don't want, you know, Little Brown specifically, my art director, David Kaplan, he specifically said, we don't want this to be gimmicky. We want to have a reason why you turn the book upside down. And I remember just saying, okay, well, imagine turning the book upside down. And then once you're upside down and you want to progress further, you still have to turn the pages the normal way. So you'll be going backwards. And they said, we don't understand the words that just came out of your mouth.
I hold this book and go like, I don't quite understand how it works that I am still progressing through the pages. It just is something that sort of blows my mind every time I read it, which is, I think, amazing.
And that's the thing, because like when Little Brown, so I sent them a PDF and I showed them a panel. I said, you will see this image, then you have to turn the book. Then you'll see this image, then you have to turn the book. And then you have to turn the page this way. And even with an instructional PDF, they didn't understand it. So what they ended up doing was they took my digital PDF dummy. They printed it out. They actually made it into a book. They had to turn it into a book that they could hold in their hands.
Yes.
And it wasn't until they actually interacted with it that they realized, oh, this is what you mean. This is what you're saying, you know? And I remember thinking to myself, I really have to design the heck out of this one spread where he has to turn it upside down, because it's just not hard enough to make an audience, you know, communicate and understand what has to be done. But a publisher, you know, a publisher really doesn't want to take those kind of chances. You know, it can be a little nerve wracking. And I said, if I can convince the publisher that this is the way it should be, then I think we're in business. And so I remember designing this. I remember just designing. I spent a whole week just on this one spread saying, you know, I rendered it out. I added color and everything, you know, just like, ooh, buy this new car. And then we ended up, you know, putting these little arrows in there. And for a moment, actually, you know, the entire publishing house got into it. They were trying to like give feedback on it. And there's always this thing about the page turn. You always want to turn towards the page turn. And so a lot of illustrators that you interview, a lot of illustrators that you talk to, they already know that they have to illustrate towards the page turn. You know, you always have that feeling that you have to go from left to right. But now, when you're making the book go against what feels natural and you're trying to get everybody to read from right to left instead, your brain still has a hard time trying to calculate that. And so there was at one point where where they were telling me, well, why don't you turn the car the other direction and make it go towards the left? That way the narrative is pushing towards the left. And so the tricky thing here is what happens is that now that you're turning the pages backwards to dictate going back in time, if you were to make the car go to the left, then you actually change the narrative. And then the car feels like it made a U-turn and it's going home.
Good call.
So we kept discussing this over and over again. And we said, no, throughout the entire story, the car always has to go from left to right because that is the narrative in the story. And in that context, the story always has to go from left to right.
I can see it. I can see how you're illustrating toward the expected page turn.
Right. And so the,
causing us to go backwards. Yeah. Right.
And then the thing that really stuck with Little Brown was they said, well, I, you know, after I turn the book upside down, I instinctively always want to turn from left to right. And then they'd say, well, are the kids going to get lost when I turn this page and they see that it's the page that they were just on? And I said, guys, listen, it's a 40-page book. No one's going to get lost. No one's going to get lost. But if they do get lost, they're going to get lost once. And then they're going to get it. And then once they do it, they're going to be able to have this secret that they can share with everybody else. Say, did you read Are We There Yet? And they go, no. Oh, you don't know the little secret in there? It really works to, you know, to help with the narrative.
You've got those text ribbons too that are like literally they're cut like ribbons to point that direction.
Right.
But one of the things that my kids made a connection here, and I don't know, you haven't had the book out in the world yet, so I don't know that you've experienced any of this yet, but my students immediately picked up that the way your book functions feels like Jason Shiga's comic Meanwhile.
Oh yeah.
That it's you're like operating in a different way, which is great. And he has a comic in the new Comic Squad Recess has like a function like that, that once you do it, it's exactly like you said, once you make the mistake one time, you just write yourself. It's like learning how to ride a bike. Once you find that balance, you know exactly what to do.
Right. Shiga's one of those mad geniuses. Like in Meanwhile, I remember, you know, you would do that thing where you would cheat with a choose your own adventure.
Yes, look at it.
And then I don't know if you knew this, but he would put in dud panels. Like you would look at a panel and say, oh, well, I'm just gonna start here. He would actually plant those as fakes that you can do that. And then there was another one, Empire City, and it's about this couple having a relationship. And then the end of the story leaves you hanging like, well, did you say yes or no? And then you can actually take the last page and hold it up into the light and it will say what she says. You know, things like that. They're just beautiful. Like he's like on a whole other level, you know?
Man.
But yeah, I mean, really for me, it was important. Like it's important for me that I hope that readers who read this book understand that I'm not turning the book upside down just as a gimmick, but that you're turning it upside down so that when you turn the pages, you're turning the pages backwards because you're going back in time.
I think even more so, the function of that feature of turning the book upside down is that you're part of the story. This is the way you have to tell the story. You are helping them progress. Like you're actually physically, it feels that you are physically causing an effect in the story.
Right. Right. You know, and I'm proud of myself. The fact that I feel like I've managed to, well, I mean, I hope that I've managed to make it feel more than a story, but more like an experience.
I totally think so. I think it's amazing.
You know, I guess the other thing that we should discuss is there's and probably years from now it'll be dated, but they're at one point where the boy has fun with this dinosaur. He gets to this dinosaur, he plays with the dinosaur, and the other aspect of a child's, you know, perception of time is that when they have time, when they have fun, like if they're at a party or, you know, at a sleepover or something, if they're having so much fun, time, you know, moves by really quickly.
Yes.
And so in this story, he's playing with the dinosaur and then he has so much fun that he actually completely passes the present day and ends up in the future. And then he's in the future, he's flying cars and, you know, astronauts and, you know, all these cool, you know, outfits and signs and everything. And there's one little thing where a robot approaches them and he takes a picture of them.
Mm-hmm.
But he communicates
in QR code.
So, you know, going again, you know, just talking about the narrative is that, you know, for the inquisitive mind, like, you know, you can look at the robot, you can look at the QR code and, you know, someone could look at that and just say that the robot is just talking in some robot jargon that's probably irrelevant, you know? Like, he doesn't have to understand what it says. And that's kind of the point of it, is that, you know, QR code can exist as a design element to look and say, oh, he's speaking in some robot language. But for any kid who's inquisitive and wants to know what it says, you know, a parent can take their iPhone and translate what the robot's saying. And it has nothing to do with the narrative. It's like, you know, the robot takes a picture, so he says, can I take your picture? Developing, memories last forever, you know, have a nice day. So there's nothing that actually adds to the narrative of the story, but, you know, anybody who's like really curious about little details in there, like I hope that they'll discover on their own. You know, like one, so going back to my son, and, you know, just on a personal level, so you know, the grandmother, the birthday party that they're going to, it's on October 24th, and October 24th is, that's my youngest son's birthday. And they actually, so when they go into the future, it's like October 24th, 2059 or something like that.
Right.
And that's the year my son turns 50. You know, I wanted it to be something for him to kind of go back to, and, you know, just, like, it could mean just as much to him on his 50th birthday as it was the year it came out, you know? Like, he can look forward to turning 50. And then he can read this book again, and he'll look at it from a completely different context.
That is... Dan Santag, you are so thoughtful. Oh, my word. That's awesome. Your kid's going to have a completely different experience with this book, because that date... Well, even all of us, I guess, it's sort of like... All of us that, well, we all, what am I trying to qualify? Like, there were a few of us that did this, but everyone loved Back to the Future too. And right, we right. were approaching and approaching and approaching that date until we hit it. We right, hit it this year. Right. So it's that sort of thing too, that everyone reading this book, that time is moving forward. We'll constantly be moving toward that date. That's, right. That's cool.
Well, I'm sure there won't be flying cars. We can hardly drive on the ground as it is, so but you know, it's one of those things. Flying cars, you know, they denote the future. You have to acknowledge flying cars in storytelling, because that's like, it's almost like, you know, when to this day, if you say the year 2000, it still sounds like the future for some weird
it
reason.
Does especially, you know? if you can hear Conan O'Brien singing it.
Right, right.
Or that's
right,
3,000. Right. My bad, not 2,000, but still.
Oh, did he change it to 3,000?
I think he changed it to 3,000. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Because I remember for the longest time, like after the year 2000 was gone, he still kept calling it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. When he was still at NBC, he still called it in the year 2000.
Yeah. Oh, that's amazing. Well, this book is amazing. I can't wait for people to read it and experience it and have that. Like, it's a book that I only have the arc. I have the F and G. And my kids have all wanted to take my copy. And I've lent it to some classrooms. But it's that. Like, this is a book that they want to, like, exactly like with Press Here, there's a magic to it. That you're a part of this story. You're playing a part of this story. And so, yes, the teacher can read it and do the trick, but can you do it? Can I also make them go back in time? Will it work when I do it? I mean, that's sort of the way every time I've picked up Are We There Yet? I feel... sort of that same way. Maybe that's why I'm saying that my brain can't quite wrap around how it works. Because to me, it feels like a sort of magic that is really special to experience. And it's rad as anything for my kid, for my son and I to read it, and for us to flip the book over, and for him just to smile. It's the greatest thing ever. And you did that, Dan. You gave him that smile with this book. That's awesome.
That's awesome. I mean, I don't think I would have been capable of writing something like this or doing something like this, say, 5 years ago.
Even that, you know, recently.
Yeah, because, yeah, like, I learned a tremendous amount from writing Beagle. And it's almost like, you know, you level up and then you just kind of have a clearer view of things. Not like you don't feel like you're a better writer, but it's almost like you're better at editing yourself or looking at something and seeing what it needs. And with Are We There Yet? Like, I had originally, with the whole time going back, I had this spread where the panels were breaking down, where it was a little you see this little analog watch, and then you're watching the second hand just tick away, and then it gets closer and closer and closer and closer and closer until the last, it's like, you know, saying tick, 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 tick. And then you get to the last window and you see the second hand go back a second. It says talk. And, you know, like I was never in love with that spread, and it kind of felt like that's the way it was going. And I knew that probably wasn't the final solution, but once I read that Naruto comic, I think I spent a good month just trying to figure out the mechanics behind it and whether or not it would work. And then I'm on a Skype group with a bunch of people, like Mike Bolt, James Burks, Renee Carrilla, Kale Atkinson. And I drew the idea and I showed it to them. I said, guys, does this work? Does this make sense? And it was really cool. Like, they all gave me some feedback. They all, you know, they were really supportive. And, you know, they said, if you can get this to work, you should really, you know, go for this idea. And so that's what really got me, you know, excited about it. It's funny because it really comes down. I can't talk enough about that spread. I'm really proud of that spread that I did.
That's awesome. I hope that others, now that it's going to be in the hands of other people, I hope they as well talk about it, because it just works. I think that you set a precedence for how to do things like this. This is how it works. This is how we help lead a reader through a story. If we want to have them experience something with us, it's storytelling through design. It's great.
I'd shown it to some teachers up in Portland. I was up in Portland for a teachers conference, and they were talking about how they actually liked how they could show it to younger kids in terms of the mechanics of how to use a book. You know, there's other ways to use a book. And I hadn't really thought of it as a teaching tool, but now that I think about it, like that's look, extra bonus, you know?
Bonus. Nice. Yeah. Right. Level up, high fives.
Yeah, that's...
Hey, so you've got it. I know from watching your feed that you got some stuff going on. What's going on with Beagle? Are they moving forward? Is it like going into production?
So what I know right now is, for those of you on the podcast who don't know, is that Beagle was optioned by DreamWorks about 2 years ago, and right. So the story is that Jason Reitman, who did Up in the Air and Juno and Thank You for Smoking, he was with his daughter in New York, and they saw the book, and he really connected with the story because the setting looks like New York, and the girl Alice in the book looks like his daughter. So he went all over Hollywood trying to find who has this property. And DreamWorks was like, hey, we have this property. And he said, what are you guys doing with it? And he was like, do you want to take a stab at it? And he was like, yes, I want to take a stab at it. And so right now he's working on the second draft of it. And I think the second draft will be ready in April. I think I'll be able to get to read that draft. I've actually been following in the footsteps of Marla Frazee and Dave Pilkey. Marla's book Boss Baby is being turned into a movie, and it's coming out. I think it's coming out next year.
Whoa.
I think it's coming out next year. Yeah, it's coming out next year, and then Dave's Captain Underpants is coming out the year after that.
Oh, you're kidding. I didn't even know that. That's amazing.
And so it's nice. Like, DreamWorks has been inviting Marla and I to, like, they invited Marla and I to the big Hollywood premiere of Kung Fu Panda 3.
That's where I saw the picture. Yeah.
You know? Oh, my gosh.
That's amazing.
You know? And
goodness.
And then Marla and I, we also caught up. They invited us to an Oscar party. We're like,
"Woo,
an Oscar party, Marla!" You know. So it's really, I've been thrilled for her. And you know, from the rumblings that I've heard from people in animation, Boss Baby sounds like it's going to be like fantastic. And for me, you know, like with Beagle, I know it's in. A lot of people ask me, "Oh, do you want to have any participation in writing or doing any of the art direction or anything?" And quite frankly, no. I don't want any. I don't want any of that at all. And I'm perfectly fine. I mean, listen, it's in good hands with Jason Reitman. And then there's also I guess there was also a little rumbling that Steven Spielberg might be consulting behind the scenes, but not.
Oh, goodness.
Like, not credited. So, yeah, I'm okay with that. Those guys can do whatever they want.
Well, and it's... I was talking to someone else who... I can't even remember who it was. But someone on this podcast was sharing, too, the idea that, you know, you... Maybe it was Adam, when I talked to Adam Rex about Home. Right. And how he just sort of said, well, he wrote the book. And so... You know, the true meaning of Smack Day is what it is, and Smack right. for President is what it is, and you have to sort of be willing to see. If you're willing to see your characters take a different path, you know, nothing's gonna be the exact same as the book, nor should it be, because it's a different medium, it's a different thing. So right. It sounds like you're in a good, healthy place for knowing that they have your story in good hands. That yeah. they want to respect the story, they came at it from a place of love, and right. that it won't be the exact same as your picture book, but it shouldn't be.
Well, the fact that it's still coming from a place of love.
Of
that,
course.
You know, Jason's doing a love letter to his daughter now.
Yes, yeah.
I've been a huge fan of his films, and I know he's gonna, like, he'll put together one amazing soundtrack.
That guy yes.
puts together some great stuff, you know, and you're right, it is totally healthy to keep a distance from it. Actually, Tony DiTrolisi gave me that piece of advice with the Spiderwick Chronicles, because when yeah. he was doing Spiderwick Chronicles, he said, yeah, I didn't, you know, I think initially he was into it, and then after a while he said, if I stick with this, I'm just gonna go insane. So okay. is it His advice to me was, look, love it from a distance. Dave well, Pilkey said the same thing, and Marla was the same way. Yeah.
Sounds like you've surrounded yourself with some sage advice. That's good.
Yeah, but, that's, yeah, it's a good time for picture book people, you know? Well, good time for people to get adapted, apparently. Yeah.
Apparently so. And my word, it's a good time to be Dan Santad. I saw stuff that you're working with Mo Willems, too.
Yeah,
what's
yeah.
going on with Mo? I mean, are you doing multiple things? I know he's got an Easy Reader series, because I saw that John Hsu did the cover reveal for that book, right?
Right. So Mo, I guess, so now that he's hanging up Elephant and Piggy, he's segueing into a series of Elephant and Piggy Presents.
Yes, yeah.
And so it's, you know, Elephant and Piggy sharing their favorite stories written by, you know, certain authors. And so I don't think they're calling it an imprint, but it's like Mo gets to dictate this brand. And so cool. he had me pitch some ideas, and I remember thinking, okay, well, here's some ideas. If some of them don't work, I could see some of these turning into, you know, maybe other picture books of my own. And Mo is a guy who just works on a completely different level. So I gave him four ideas, and he liked two of them. And then, but the thing was that he gave such a quick, tight analysis of the other three, and he made them so much better that now I'm kind of like, well, now I can't write this because you made it so much better. Like, I don't even want to touch it. Like, it's so. He's like gonna. He has a very good, sharp mind about, just, you know, the voice to a child and how they're gonna relate to it, and how, you know, action is passive or active. And I wasn't even seeing that kind of stuff at first, you know. And
he was brilliant ever since Sesame Street. Probably before really? That, he just yeah. he knows it.
And so he was kind of like co-editing on the side with the editor Tracy Keevan. And Tracy's been his editor for, you know, the Elephant and Piggy stuff. And it was just such a great process, you know. And Mo wasn't, he wasn't like steering the boat. He would get my narrative, and then he would add on top of it. He would add on top of it and say, well, how about this? Well, you know, what do you think of this? And then we would just feed back and forth. And by the time it was done, it just fits really that, like, that elephant and piggy formula is just such a fun medium to work with.
Oh, it's so good. Yeah.
And so the story, the Cookie Fiasco, my story is called The Cookie Fiasco, and it's about three friends. It's about four friends, two squirrels, a brother and sister squirrel, a crocodile, and a hippo. And they're on a playground, and they, and then snack time comes, but there's only three cookies. And so they have to figure out how to, divide these three cookies evenly. And so while they're trying to do the math in their head, while they're trying to do all these other things, the entire book's drawn, you know, drawn and painted two-dimensionally, but actually when they're in their thoughts, everything is three-dimensional. We kind of like that idea that, like, their imaginations were...
Okay, this is where those puppets came from. I see these puppets. Right. Oh, that's so cool.
Right. So I made the sculptures of all of them. And I went so far as to sculpt about the author. I did a sculpture of myself. I did a sculpture of Mo. It was just an incredible learning experience to work with Mo.
Oh, that's so great. And awesome too, that however many books in you are with illustrating with other people's manuscripts and doing your own, and you've got this stuff going on with Beagle and all that, that to still be learning is so, it's always exciting to talk to you, because I know you're a person that's always learning and challenging yourself, and that's just awesome. And you've got something coming out with First Second.
Oh yes. Yeah. So
they're just the greatest in the world. I know that I don't shy away from saying how much I love the work that they're doing.
Yeah. So it's going back to talking about where do you go from winning the Caldecott? And I remember talking to my editor Connie Hsu a while back about, so what happened? This happened from like BEA. This is like BEA, I want to say like 3 or 4 years ago, and I was promoting Frankenstein. And I remember I was at this breakfast with Peter Brown, and then we were talking to a table of like 13, 15 librarians. And one of them asked me, I think it was someone from the Horn Book. I forgot who it was. Someone from the Horn Book had asked me, so how did you get into children's publishing? And I told the whole story about how I went from biology into art, and how it was about, you know, kind of, you know, feeling like I needed to live up to my parents' expectations, because, you know, their whole lives they wanted me to grow up and be a doctor, but deep inside I always wanted to be an artist, you know. And culturally, you know, that's it's a tough thing to kind of say, look, Mom and Dad, you know, I know I've been raised and you want me to, you know, grow up and be a doctor, but it's not for me. And so this is actually this graphic novel, it covers a span of about 12 years of my life. And it talks about a lot of things that happened in my life that, you know, I'm not holding any punches. I'm talking about all kinds of stuff. Like, I'm talking about my mom's breast cancer. I'm talking about, you know, the time I lost my virginity. I'm talking about the first time I ever drew a nude figure. Just all these different things. And really, it's kind of this moment where I get to have some perspective, and you forcefully have to put yourself in your parents' shoes and have an unobjective, like an unbiased view of why they do things the way they do. It's just been a really fascinating exercise on just understanding my parents and who they were. And you know, I would talk to a lot of people, like I would talk to Raina Telgemeier and CC Bell, about just kind of the parameters of the memoir, the autobiography, and just kind of saying, well, how much can you stretch the truth? How much of it is, you know, completely, you know, as the way it was told? You know, I would have to say that factually the entire thing would probably be, you know, maybe 75-80% true. And a lot of it is just really heavy. I guess they're like, Connie wants to call it my David Small's book, Stitches.
Yes.
It's wow. By like, it's like my, it's my stitches. And you know, so
what high praise. That's amazing.
Well, that's kind of big shoes to fill too. So.
No doubt. Good Lord. Yes.
and so like, and the other thing is, well, that kind of goes along with the whole struggles of where you go after winning the Caldecott. Cause I remember Jody, my agent, Jody Reamer, she called me and she said, well, now that we've finished, are we there yet? We finished the 2-book deal. So it's now is a good time as any to sell our next projects. And so I was working on these picture book manuscripts and I had the worst case of writer's block because everything I wrote, I was comparing it to Beagle. Everything, it has to be as good as Beagle. This isn't good enough. It has to say something important. Mm. And you know, like a month and a half into it, and this was before I even got the medal. Like this was before, like I was awarded the medal, but I didn't actually go through the ceremony yet, you know? And Jody calls me up and she says, you need to take a month off because you're beating yourself up and you're not enjoying any of this. And she said, take 30 days off and then relax. You have to relax because you're not going to write anything, you know, being as tense as you are. So it wasn't until, gosh, what, 2 weeks into it, 2 weeks into my little vacation, my forced vacation, I was just really grouchy. I was like, oh, gosh, relaxing stinks. Who does this? And then it wasn't until like a month into it, I noticed that my mind was just kind of wandering and thinking of things. And then, you know, the family and I, we went to Hawaii after San Francisco, after the banquet. And then the ideas just clicked together. And that's how I came up with my new picture book ideas. But, specifically, you know, Jody also said, look, you know, you might want to tackle new ground and this memoir will be huge. Like, and I think it'd be important for you to do, not just because it's me writing to a different audience in a different voice, but also there are people out there who probably need a story like this. And I never thought of it that way, you know? I always thought of myself as, I don't know why, I always thought of myself as the one struggling Asian kid that wanted to be an artist. But, you know, there are a ton of, you know, kids out there who have to, I want to look at it as less of a story about what it's like to be Asian in America. I don't look at the story that way. I look at it more as a moment in your life when you finally realize that your parents aren't perfect people, you know, and they do the best that they can. And that in moments in your life that are probably really dark, probably really painful, also define who you are as a person, depending on how you handle that pain.
That so sounds that's, amazing. That sounds then, like a lot of brave territory to be covering.
Right. But, and I'm also making it like, so also intertwined in it is I'm using my life as a metaphor to Rime of the Ancient Mariner. So I'm actually going to be drawing Rime of the Ancient Mariner in this graphic novel.
Oh my goodness gracious, Dan Zantat.
It's a big white whale. It's a big white one. Yeah. Big, big project.
Well, go do it. I should. What are we still talking for? You have work to do. Dan, it's been a pleasure. I love catching up with you. I just love you. You're a great guy. I'm glad you exist in the world, and I'm glad you work so hard to connect with our kids and to share stories. You're such a great asset to this world. Such a treasure to all of us readers, big and small. And
thank you. You and your podcast do a wonderful service to the community as well. I'm glad it's doing so well. And I'll see you in Texas in a couple weeks, right?
Yes, I will. I can't wait to see you in Texas. Before I let you go, I have a question that I'm going to let you have the final word on. And it goes back to those kids that we're talking about. And then, yes, I look forward to seeing you. So yeah. I'm going to see a library full of children tomorrow, Dan. And I would love to know what message that you would like for me to bring them from you.
Read what you love. Don't read what people tell you that you have to read to be smarter or to be better. You know, read what you love. Just love to read. That's because when I was a kid, my parents they had a very utilitarian you know, utilitarian approach to it. Like, oh, why don't you read a biology book? It'll make you understand biology better. Why don't you read a math book? It wasn't until I started reading things that I liked that I actually I loved reading. And unfortunately, it took all the way till junior high when I finally found the right things that I like to read. But, you know, you can't create new ideas if you don't have ideas to be inspired from. And so, you know, I say read what you love and immerse yourself in life.
This podcast is recorded and produced by me, Matthew Winner, in my library studio in Ellicott City, Maryland. You can subscribe to the podcast and access the archive of over 250 episodes at All the Wonders, a home for readers to discover new books and to experience the stories they love in wondrous ways. Go beyond the book at allthewonders.com and check out other podcasts from All the Wonders, including the Picture Booking Podcast with Nick Patton, a semi-weekly podcast about picture books and the people who make them. Our theme music is by Emily Arrow. All views and opinions expressed on the show are those of the individuals, myself included, and do not reflect ideas or viewpoints of the publishers of the books referenced. Listeners, if the episode connected with you, I'd love to hear it. Leave a comment on allthewonders.com or rate this podcast on iTunes or Stitcher through stars or reviews. Sharing the podcast with friends through Facebook and Twitter, word of mouth, or any other means helps reach more listeners, which leads to more content and more amazing guests. And that's a very good thing indeed. Coming up on the podcast, we're celebrating the 250th episode with very special guest Kate DiCamillo, whose newest novel, Raimi Nightingale, will move you deeply. You're going to love it, and so will all your friends. And after that, Pseudonymous Bosch has secrets to keep and secrets to share, but not without first talking about Bad Luck, his second book in the Bad Books series. See you then, and thanks for listening. We know you value what you put in front of your kids, especially when it comes to screens and podcasts. That's why we're excited to share a new podcast from our friends at Sleepiest, creating bedtime stories to help your kids fall asleep fast.
Hello, Abby here. If you've got children and find bedtime's a struggle, I'd like to tell you about Coco Sleep, a children's story podcast designed to make bedtime a dream. Coco Sleep turns a chaotic bedtime into cozy bonding time. The stories are delivered in a pace that gently slows. Rumour has it that no one's ever heard an ending. So search Coco Sleep on your favourite podcast app and let's make bedtime a dream. That's K-O-K-O Sleep, and I'll see you there.